From NPR News in New York, this is the Bryant Park Project with Allison Stewart and Luke Burbank.
You are listening to the Bryant Park Project. 2 hours today, 2 hours of news, information, and Fidel Castro has muerto rumors. Okay, I busted out the Spanish
now? I didn't understand that last part of that sentence, but I'm piecing it together. You're Allison Stewart. I'm Luke Burbank. You know, the problem is that one listener had a two-for-one coupon. So they pay for the first hour, but then we have to do the second hour for free.
I'm willing. I'm ready, and I think I'm able.
We'll see what happens. I think that about the second hour of the show could be a lot of me doing karaoke.
All right.
At this point.
I look forward to that. We're also going to have the Ramble, a story about the Vatican and its own airline, but you can't bring bottles of holy water aboard, apparently.
They're equal opportunity with the security there at the airport. We also are going to have a Miss Teen South Carolina remix. You know, that tape where she kind of mangled the answer from the thing. We've actually, with the help of Mo Rocca, decided to try to rejigger it a little bit. We'll hear how that turned out.
Also going to take a look at Congress coming back to work. Isn't that nice of them? It's going to happen next Tuesday, right after Labor Day. We'll talk about what's going to happen.
And we are very excited. Our first two-hour show, we have a live in-studio performance from Mark Olson. You probably know him from the Jayhawks and also his solo work. All that is coming up, but right now it is time for the big story.
Today's big story, a look at what's officially titled the Report of the Review Panel presented to the Governor, Tom Kaine, of the Commonwealth of Virginia. It's over 140 pages, consisting of 11 chapters describing how the mass shooting of 32 students and faculty at Virginia Tech took place and what could have been done and can be done in the future to prevent another tragedy.
The panel members, that included, by the way, an FBI veteran, a professor of psychiatry, a circuit court judge, they conducted over 200 interviews. They read thousands of pages of info, and they found out some facts, like the shooter, Sung Hui Choi. He had 400 rounds of ammunition on him that day. Five of the teachers who were killed, they died trying to protect students. Misjudgment seems to be kind of the overarching theme of this report that came out. The blame, of course, still the majority of the blame lies with the shooter, but there are also details about sort of cracks in the system and how unusual the circumstances were.
School officials, I've lost my place, Luke. Here we go. Law enforcement is called out for not adequately informing university officials about future danger. Actually, I was just getting a note that it's Tim Kaine, not Tom Kaine.
Oh, right.
The typo. Let me get back to the script
law
here.
Law enforcement.
Thank you very much. Local police and campus police responded appropriately on most fronts, but for, quote, one large and unfortunate exception, the officers focus on one lead. They focused on the boyfriend of one of the first people killed, and that was dubbed as premature. Police were wrong to tell campus officials the shooter had likely left the premises.
This was a thing that kind of blew me away. The school officials didn't really follow all the rules, but this one specific thing, when the shooter went into one of the academic buildings, he left behind a bomb threat on a chained door, and instead of following protocol and calling police, a faculty member took that note to the dean's office, and then right after that was when the shooting started.
Now, during the entire event, campus officials are cited as not having systems to adequately notify students of the danger or by containing the danger by simply canceling classes.
Yeah, the panel also says that a lack of understanding of privacy laws is the most significant problem. Many different agencies saw this guy Cho as a threat, but the information about his writings and mental health treatment back to his middle school years, that wasn't shared because of how they interpreted privacy laws.
I'm troubled that a student who had talked about Columbine at an earlier point in his life, that information was unknown to anybody on the Tech campus.
That was Governor Kaine there. Now, the recommendations from the report range from campus police should train with the local police. Dispatchers should be careful about what to tell 911 callers without knowing the situation. For example, telling students to stay put might not be the right answer. 10 students survived in this incident by jumping out of their classroom window.
Right. Campuses also are not to relay only technology. They're not supposed to just use email, you know, to let students know that there might be some danger. And there are a lot of other things in this report that we actually don't have time to get to, but we're going to link it to our website, which is npr.org/Bryant Park. That is our big story for this hour. Now let's hear Matt Martinez with the news.
This is NPR.
Thanks, guys. Good morning, everyone. Congressional auditors say that the Iraqi government has failed to meet the vast majority of political and military goals laid out by Congress. The Government Accountability Office report says that at least 13 of the 18 benchmarks to measure the surge of U.S. troops to Iraq are unfulfilled ahead of a September 15th deadline. That's when President Bush will give a detailed report on the 8-month-long surge. Pakistan's President General Pervez Musharraf will step down as the head of Pakistan's military. Now, that's according to the country's exiled former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto. Bhutto said that she is negotiating a power-sharing deal with Musharraf, but a government spokesman says that Musharraf has not yet decided whether to step down as army chief. The United Nations Nuclear Agency says that Iran is producing less nuclear fuel than originally thought. It also praises Tehran for a significant step forward in explaining past atomic actions that have raised suspicions. This latest report is expected to make it difficult for the United States to rally support for a new round of sanctions against Tehran. Rescuers at the Utah mine, where six miners are trapped, are expected to break through to a chamber where they think they might have taken refuge. They've been drilling a seventh hole to lower a robotic camera into. U.S. Mine Safety Chief Kevin Strickland says rescue workers will continue searching for the men as long as there's a possibility they're alive, but he says that likelihood decreases each day. Hillary Clinton will give $23,000 in donations she has received to charity. The money she's giving away was raised by a fundraiser who is wanted in California for failing to appear for sentencing on a 1991 grand theft charge. The founder of legendary New York punk rock club CBGB's has died. Hilly Kristal ran the club that helped make the Ramones, Blondie, and Talking Heads stars. He was 75. The remains of the world's most famous human ancestor, Lucy, will go on public display for the first time in the United States this week. Some scientists say that her 3.2 million-year-old bones are too fragile for a tour, but the show will indeed go on. Lucy will go on an 11-city tour starting at the Houston Museum of Natural Science. And it is hot in Phoenix. The normally hot city has set a new hot record with a reading of 113 degrees yesterday. It set a record for 29 straight days of temperatures over 110 degrees. The old record is 28 days, and that was set back in 1970. I'm Matt Martinez. The news is always online at npr.org. Back to you, Luke and Allison.
I don't know why Matt would ever leave.
I know.
Yeah, the greater Phoenix area.
Yeah,
have you talked to your family?
I have talked to
them.
How
are they?
They've been in the pool swimming. And, you know, it's not a relief at all because the water is like... It's a cup of tea. It's like 86 degrees. You know, you go swimming. So not so much help there.
Make a cup of me tea. Not really fun. All right, Matt Martinez, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Last Friday, news organizations went scrambling as internet rumors took hold that Fidel Castro died.
Team now live in Little Havana, where the crowds have been gathering all day waiting to find out the answer to an age-old question once again. Fidel Castro, the talk of the town. Rumors running rampant that the aging dictator is dead. We want to stress yet again that these are only rumors.
Okay, that's a local report from Miami. This happened last Friday, but it also happened the Friday before. They started calling it Castro Friday, kind of like Casual Friday, because people split. They leave work, they head to the streets and start to party. It's a big issue in Miami. We're going to check out with the Miami Police Chief John Timoney in just a moment to talk about what is really the plan when Castro passes away. But first, a columnist who's had it with these Fidel rumors. His recent column is titled, "Hang on, Little Havana, Friday's coming, and so are the rumors." Ralph De La Cruz of the Sun Sentinel in Florida joins us now on this Thursday. So what do you think? Will there be a rumor tomorrow, Ralph?
Oh, I wouldn't put it past it. I'm getting my guayabera ready, getting a little mojito, you know. It's time for the party, I guess. But seriously, I do hope at some point we're able to get past all this. It seems like... Fidel just always has had a little bit too much influence on our lives here, and actually he should be increasingly irrelevant, and it's going the other way sometimes, it feels like.
Let me ask you to describe the kind of phone calls you started to receive the last two Fridays about Castro.
I've been getting my parents live in South Texas, and we're Cuban, and I've been getting calls from home. My mother calling up, "Hey, so Fidel died, huh? And I have to tell her, well, I'm not so sure about that. I don't think that there have been reliable reports. The next day she calls up, your uncle says your cousin called up and said that everybody's running out into the streets in Miami. Wait. Let me turn on the TV. I'm sure they'd cover it. Nobody out in the streets. Although a lot of people on websites say they're ready to get out there. And I think a lot of it depends on if you're the older generation or the newer generation. I think for the older generation, when he dies, eventually there is going to be a lot of emotion. I think for perhaps the younger generation, there's going to be a lot of partying.
Can you explain to me why there's so much anticipation of the news of Castro's death? It just seems like there's this puddle of gas waiting for a match every week.
Yeah, Castro is bigger than just a person. He's a symbol of a lot of things to a lot of people. And even though he's not running the government anymore, his passing is a signal, a symbol of the passing of something of terrible memories, of harsh emotions, of families being split up. And that's what he represents, and people are ready to bury that.
Do you think
I certainly am.
Do you think that part of it is he's sort of passed power on to his brother, Raul, it would appear now, and he is sort of receding into the background of political life in Cuba. Do you think – does that mean that this is going to become less and less of a big deal, or is the anticipation making it a bigger – what direction are we going with this?
I think I think that eventually the longer it drags out, the less anticipation there's going to be. I saw a documentary on the Brooklyn Dodgers the other night, and they talked about how the fact that it leaked out, the news of them leaving Brooklyn and going to Los Angeles took such a long time to leak out that by the time eventually that the announcement came out, people were like, oh, okay, so what? And I think that eventually that could happen here, although there's still so much passion about Castro and about Cuba that there's going to be some reaction. I can almost guarantee that I think people will go out into the streets, and I think you will see some partying. But I think the longer this drags out, the more subdued that's going to be.
Let me ask you about the whole party atmosphere. I was sort of surprised to see it. It looked like a street fair, a street festival, as the rumors started up.
Well, you know, I think the more personal it is, and the closer it is to your time when he took power, the more it is about the event of this man dying. I think the further away you get from it in terms of age, if you're 18, 20, you weren't in Cuba in 1959, you're going to be looking at it more as an event in and of itself. Whereas if you had to leave behind part of your family, if you had to put your life on the line crossing the Florida Strait,
sure,
and getting here, it's still a very personal thing. If you had somebody who was killed, it's not a party time. It's a time to be letting go of a lot of that. Although even the older folks, I think there will be a party. My folks bought a bottle of Cuban champagne. They call it Cesar. It's hard apple cider, and at a store, and it says to be open in the event of Fidel's death. So I think a few of the old timers will be tipping glasses of champagne or Cesar when they hear the news. But for the most part, I think there's going to be a lot of reflection and just a lot of emotion for them.
Ralph De La Cruz of the Sun Sentinel in Florida, thank you so much.
Appreciate it. Have a great day.
You too now. Miami police are also well aware there will be crowds in the streets once Castro dies. Miami Police Chief John Timoney joins us. Chief Timoney, have you done practice runs in anticipation of that day?
Well, you may remember exactly a year ago this time, at the end of the summer, last summer, there was a... You know, there's been numerous reports of this guy's demise, but last summer it was at a fever pitch, and there were spontaneous demonstrations along Calle Ocho, which is the cultural heart of Little Havana, and so people came out on the streets. Not unusual, but the rumors were running wild that in fact he had passed. We know that he was very sick, and really what took place was the transferring of power from Fidel over to Raul, who now holds a seat of power. So we had that was a pretty good dry run for us, what to expect. There were no surprises. We have what's called a Cuba plan in the event this man dies, and it's got multi-layers. But the most obvious one is the spontaneous emotional reaction that will happen, particularly along Cayocho, particularly in front of the Versailles restaurant.
Sure.
Which is a celebration point for Cuban Americans.
Chief, do you have the cooperation of community leaders? Have you reached out to them in anticipation of Castro's death?
Oh, yeah. There is a regular outreach to the community and the city manager. The police, we have our plan. And our plan really, I mean, there's no expectation whatsoever of trouble. But clearly, there will be issues such as traffic and things of that nature. And so we have a police plan. But the city manager, clearly there are other agencies involved and community leaders. And so the city manager has over the last year begun a series of meetings and outreach to not just other city agencies, but also to leaders in the Cuban American community.
Miami Police Chief John Timoney, thanks for spending some time with us today.
My pleasure.
You're listening to the Bryant Park Project from NPR News.
Welcome back to the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. I'm Luke Burbank.
And I'm Allison Stewart. Thanks for spending part of your day with us. Coming up, we're going to have Mark Olson performing live in the studio for an interview about his new album and documentary, which is premiering tonight. So that's kind of exciting. But first, time for us to take a wander through the news we aren't sure you can use. It's called The Ramble.
I spilled vitamin water all over the keyboard like 1 second before the show started. Yeah. Now it's every time I try to type H, my finger sticks. In the Ramble, pilgrims traveling on the Vatican. Speaking of water, that was a deft segue, by the way. Speaking of water, on the Vatican's new chartered airline will not be allowed to bring more than 100 milliliters of holy water on board because of security rules. The airline does provide each passenger with a small bottle of holy water in a bottle shaped like the Virgin Mary once they're on board the plane for the ride home.
Wow.
Yeah.
Back here in the States, students returning to Port Huron in New York to school will find their principal, Gary Sorace. Or Sorace, as well. His name is now Jenna. He has become a she over the summer, and he's receiving quite, she is receiving quite a bit of support, I should say.
Yeah, school kids don't need much to go on to make fun of somebody, so this will be interesting to see.
A maturity
if
test.
If their better nature wins out or not. Three Missouri men concocted an elaborate and really ingenious scheme to steal a case of beer from a convenience store. Here was the plan, Allie. One guy went into the store naked, wearing a mask, and he began to do a hula dance with a hula hoop. That was supposed to create a distraction while the second guy stole the beer and the third manned the getaway car. It kind of worked. They got away with the beer but were arrested a couple of days later. No word on if they recovered the beer or not. I think they'd had a few before they concocted
that plan. I was
about
to say, I think they're probably beer aficionados before they even got there. This is a fascinating story. A white dolphin, which was declared extinct just last year, is believed to have been seen in China's Yangtze River. The white dolphin is very revered in China and is referred to as the goddess of Yangtze. Maybe she was just taking some time off and then found out she was declared extinct and said, hey, I'm here, boys.
People love the dolphins.
They're beautiful.
I mean, what is not to love? That, by the way, would be the ramble for today. Moving on to other news. There's a lot of fire news in the last couple of weeks, I guess, which makes sense because it's, you know, the end of summer. Everything's really dried out. Last night in Boston, two firefighters died. 12 more were hurt fighting a fire at a restaurant. Here in New York City, firefighters died last weekend fighting a fire at a vacant building near Ground Zero. Yeah. And, of course, the sort of big ones have been these wildfires in Greece where, like, 64 people so far are dead. And they're calling them the worst fires in living memory there, which kind of tells you how bad it's gotten. The government has arrested 11 people, including a grandmother, for allegedly setting some of the fires, which I've always sort of wondered, you know, when you're talking about a gigantic forest fire, how do they actually figure out how it started, where it started?
Who to arrest, whether it's arson or not.
Yeah, I mean, because you're talking about this giant, you know, scorched piece of earth. I don't know. It just – it always amazes me that they actually are able to pinpoint it as much as they seem to be able to do. Well, to get a little bit more light shed on this, we were able to track down Nina Scotti. She's the founder and president of NMS Investigations in California. Investigate arson, fire, explosions. Before that, she spent 21 years at the Pasadena Fire Department. Hi, Nina.
Hello. Good morning.
Well, let's just start off with the first question. How do they actually sort of go into a big burned out chunk of like forest and actually go, here's where it started with this kind of a thing? Doesn't it all just look the same?
Well, to the normal eye, it does. But however, as investigators, we're trained to look at certain things that lead us to the area of origin. One of the main key pieces of evidence that we could have are witness statements. What did they see when the fire first broke out?
I mean, how do you have witnesses, though, if something starts in the middle of, you know, the woods?
Well, there's people in the area that are familiar with a particular area. They know, you know, people that frequent that area. Do they drive, you know, trucks in that area? Is there equipment being used in that area? And all that could help investigators find out, are we dealing with a fire that could be accidental, or are we dealing with a fire that was intentionally set?
I mean, can you see, like, markings and stuff if someone used gasoline or if they left a cigarette? I mean, would a cigarette butt? Like they're saying, you know, I just came from California recently, and a lot of times they'd say, oh, it was, you know, someone tossed a cigarette butt out their car. How do they, like, doesn't that get incinerated? How much evidence is left?
Well, you got to understand, too, where the fire starts. It starts out really slow, and then it burns outward. And that has a lot to do with the temperature of the fuels and the wind. What it will do is it will leave the area where it initially starts slow burning, and it was it propagates outward, it increases in intensity. So the area of less destruction or damage will kind of be untouched. So you are going to find evidence of possible devices or cigarette butts. They've even found matches in the area of origin.
Wow, you think that would be the thing that would really go up, a pack of matches?
Not necessarily. There's, you know, remains of the cover or, you know, the matchstick, and there have been investigators that have found these in the area of origin.
This sounds kind of like a dumb question, but is it hard to start a forest fire? I mean, can you just throw down one match, or does it take some actual work?
Well, you got to look at what's going on in Greece, too, is you have extreme high temperatures, and you have, you know, forest land that hasn't burned in years. The forest and the vegetation has been very dried out, and you have intense winds. All that will start a fire, and it will burn forever.
Well, Nina Scotti, founder and president of the arson investigation firm NMS in California, thanks a lot for kind of shedding some light on this.
Okay.
I think this is the part of the show where we want to talk to Matt Martinez with some news headlines. Would that be right, Allison?
That would be correct.
This is NPR.
Thanks, guys. Congressional auditors say that the Iraqi government has failed to meet the vast majority of political and military goals laid out by Congress. The Associated Press is reporting that a Government Accountability Office report says that at least 13 of the 18 benchmarks to measure the surge of U.S. troops to Iraq are unfulfilled ahead of a September 15th deadline. A new report says that Virginia Tech officials could have saved lives if they had acted quickly
quickly and issued a campus-wide warning that two students had been shot to death in a dormitory and their killer was on the loose. It took administrators more than 2 hours to get a strongly worded email out to the students and staff. Sung-hui Cho had time to leave the dorm, mail a letter, and then return to the classroom building where he chained the doors shut and killed 31 more people, including himself. Rescuers at the Crandall Canyon mine in Utah are expected to break through to a chamber today where 6 missing miners may have taken refuge. They've been drilling a 7th hole to lower a robotic camera into. U.S. Mine Safety Chief Kevin Strickland says rescue workers will continue searching for the men as long as there's a possibility they're alive. And the government says the economy grew during the spring at the strongest pace in more than a year. The Commerce Department reports that the gross domestic product, which is the broadest measure of economic health, expanded at an annual rate of 4% in the April to June quarter. That's significantly higher than the 3.4% forecast. I'm Matt Martinez. The news is always online at npr.org.
Thanks, Maddie.
Miss Teen South Carolina is getting more than her 15 minutes of fame because, frankly, she's earned it with that answer to a fairly simple question during a recent beauty pageant.
Recent polls have shown a fifth of Americans can't locate the U.S. on a world map. Why do you think this is?
I personally believe that U.S. Americans are unable to do so because some people out there in our nation don't have maps, and I believe that our education, like such as in South Africa and the Iraq, everywhere like such as, and I believe that they should, our education over here in the U.S. should help the U.S. or should help South Africa and should help the Iraq and the Asian countries, so we will be able to build up our future for our children.
Thank you very much, South Carolina.
All I can think is thank God for that bell.
Poor Mario Lopez, the guy who was hosting. You know, Ali.
Did you ever think you'd say poor Mario Lopez in your life?
I have said it hundreds of times. This is just the first time it's, you know, been for reasons other people knew about. You know, we had a little rough start to this show today, Ali. We should have just used such as.
That would have been a nice transition.
Bridge a few of the gaps that we created.
Well, our friend, TV, radio, and internet personality Mo Rocca came up with this amazing plan to mine a few more precious moments out of that video gold. So, Mo, tell us what the Miss Teen USA scramble is.
You forgot vaudeville personality also. You got internet, radio, and television.
Hey, you were in the Putnam County Spelling Bee, right?
Yeah, I'm also a song and dance man. I mean, come on.
I
realized when listening to Miss South Carolina that she had all the words. She just was running on, I think, faulty software. And the references to South Africa I thought were particularly strange and outdated. So I think she was running on Pageant 95 software. But, so I asked readers to come to my website.
You needed to upgrade to Cougar. That would be the OS system for aging pageant queens.
And asking them to unscramble the words and make sense of it. And I had over 750 submissions. And actually, we just went online now with the 6 finalists. I couldn't narrow it to 5. So there will be a winner and I guess 5 runners up. And I tried to select sort of different attitudes from Miss South Carolina because people came up with really, really creative interpretations for what she was trying to say using only the words that she said.
Now, what seems to be the biggest obstacle, because I'm assuming you tried this yourself, is it that there aren't any verbs? Is it the pauses? Is it the such as?
My readers looked for opportunity, looked for potential in her lack of any punctuation. There was nothing. She just ran all the words together. And so you can really use punctuation to create some fascinating combinations. One of the biggest struggles was the 2 uhs. She says twice. Some people argue that she said it 3 or 4 times, but I only heard it twice really clearly. But some people turned that into an into an affirmation or a no-no. They ran them together, which I thought was really neat. Other people took the U.S., and because I gave them the latitude to play with punctuation and took the periods out of it and turned U.S. into us. So there was a lot of creativity going on.
Hey, Mo, what's your website, MoRocca180?
It's MoRocca180.com. It's just the numbers 180, MoRocca180.com. The polls have just opened, and right now our anti-globalization Miss South Carolina is in the lead.
Oh, really? Could you read that one to us, the one that's in the lead?
This is from Cal. He portrays a frantic Miss South Carolina terrified by globalization and presumably the rise of China. Iraq, the U.S., Africa, South Africa, they are everywhere in our maps. I personally don't have a future. For our nation to build up our education like the Asian countries, people should help because I'd be unable to do so. And, I believe that we should help our Americans over there in Iraq, believe that such education will help out here in the U.S. or the South as in such. And so should some believe the U.S. as that able? Okay, it falls apart a little bit.
That was the end. Mo, that was amazing. So those are actually all the words that she used. Wait, could you use words more than once?
No, I only selected those who used every word the same number. Like believe she used three times. You had to use it three times. Was twice. This person did something really interesting when she said, "I don't believe I have a future." They used the as the article . Which I thought was really great because it also fit contextually that this is a Miss South Carolina who's not really confident with the English language.
Right, that's the way she would have spelled it, probably.
Exactly. Now, here's a really interesting – this is the Dobbsian approach, and I like this as in Lou Dobbs. She's a real nativist here, but she begins in a very human way. She admits to being confused by the question, but then she gets right on track, and she becomes a really hot Lou Dobbs. Here we go. Maps? I believe that as the Americans are unable to do our education here, the able and or Asian countries will be our future. So over for the U.S. Some people out there don't like our nation. I personally believe that so because they believe the U.S. should have to help everywhere. South Africa and such should help in South Africa, and Iraq and such should help in Iraq. And we, as in the U.S., should build up our education. I like that.
Wow, that is amazing. She would have gotten first place.
I thought and what she's done is she's taken this strain of protectionist nativist politics and she's put a really great face and perfect teeth on it.
Well, we decided to try to do our radio equivalent of what you're working on.
We basically
on,
took your idea, Mo. Yeah, we just wanted to be straight up about that.
With I think some help from Robert Smith, NPR correspondent extraordinaire, who I think maybe tipped us off. I just want to make sure we're giving credit where credit's due.
All right. Sure. Why not? Yeah.
And so we had a little bit of a producer challenge, and we had our producers. We gave them
Who's going first?
A fixed amount of time to.
We're going to do win first.
Okay, that's
30 minutes.
We gave everybody 30 minutes
right.
to go ahead and cut up the audio of Miss South Carolina and
rejigger it all.
Rejigger it and make something maybe not as poetic as what you had, but here's the audio clip. First, we've got Wynn Rosenfeld, who's a video producer, but he's, dabbling in audio here. Well said.
Whatever.
What do you miss, South Carolina?
Such as.
Let's take a listen to Wynn's.
Personally believe that the U.S. should leave Iraq and the Asian countries, such as Africa and South everywhere, to people in the future.
That sounded like the CD was skipping.
It did. What was your biggest challenge there, Oldwin?
Well, I was just trying to sort of convey what I think she really meant, which was that she feels like countries like Africa and South everywhere should really be left to the people of the future.
Wait, are you saying that they should be left to fend? Is this sort of like an anti-nation building thing?
I think so, yeah. I think that maybe she's saying that we all sort of live in South everywhere.
I want you to... After the show, you're taking me to a map and showing me South everywhere. When?
Where isn't South everywhere, Allison?
Okay.
Who's up next?
We're going to go to MJ. MJ Davis.
This is about to be mortifying and lame.
How long did you take to do this, MJ?
I took 30 minutes.
Of your knowing how much you had to do in the past 24 hours, that's a huge chunk
rough.
Of your time.
And I was so disappointed in the final product. There's nothing gratifying about this experience.
No disclaimers. That's not what pageant contestants do.
Such as?
I believe that my video remix is the best remix ever made.
MJ, MJ tries to front like she wasn't in pageant in growing up in North Carolina.
So was not.
Let's take a listen to MJ's.
I personally believe that Americans are unable to do so because we don't believe in a bounce. Personally, I believe in a bounce, and I believe that people in the Asian countries should help educate the U.S. in a bounce.
That was kind of dance remixy. I thought she was about to say, I believe in a thing called love.
Kind of hip-hop vibe.
What's funny is the music, because there's music underneath it. It's so hard to cut it together. And at certain points, it sounds like the record is coming, like the needle's coming off the record at about the same time when the wheels are coming off of her pageant.
Right. Now, you didn't follow Moe's rules, because there was liberal use of the word maps.
We would never have cut it under Moe's rules. But we said, like, anything goes. This was really dirty play by the producers of the BPP.
All right, final entry. Dan Pashman.
Right, and I should add that, that there are certain advantages to Moe's rules, because you can move punctuation, as he explained, to really change meaning, whereas when you actually hear the way the words are pronounced, it's harder to alter.
All right. A poor craftsman blames his medium.
Well, I'm proud to say that I did mine in 19 minutes.
19?
Oh, wow. Okay, you get points. Now put your headphones on there, producer extraordinaire.
Hopefully, all right.
In case Moe wants to talk to you or something.
Let's take a listen to Dan's.
I personally believe Americans should help South Africa and should help Iraq and the Asian countries, because some people out there don't have maps, and I believe the U.S. should help people such as South Africa and Iraq, so we will be able to build up our future for our children.
Thank you very much, South Carolina.
Wow, that's what she actually might have been able to say.
Great.
That was totally, no offense, guys.
It's so bold, considering what's going on in Iraq and everything. Here she is saying, I don't care. Globalization is the future, and we have got to get out there. And American education and our place in the world depends on helping others right now. She's undaunted. I mean, she works for the Bush White House.
It's entirely possible.
Wow.
Given some
of
the president's speeches.
You know, one of the things we wanted to do, which I guess we probably didn't actually get around to because you guys were too busy piecing together every bit of this show while I watched To Catch a Predator online. We'll talk about that later. Was we were going to have all the leave-ins, all the things that got left out. And that would have been a kind of, an interesting little study too. And the kind of detritus, the audio detritus of what – because, Dan, did you leave a lot out of yours? Because yours made way more sense than the other ones.
Well, thank you. A fair amount. There's probably maybe 10 or 15 seconds worth of audio. I could go back and see if I can re-piece that together.
No, that's good. It's good.
Really,
I think
really
we've
good.
Heard enough.
But, Mo, if you want us to send you a copy of that audio, feel free. You can throw it up on your website.
I would love that. And I encourage everyone, please vote. I mean, you have the right to come to Morocco180.com and vote for your favorite unscrambling in Miss South Carolina's answer and take advantage of it. It's just a click away.
Mo Rocca, thank you so much for joining us and inspiring us as well.
What's that?
And inspiring us as well.
Oh, of course. Can I give you just one more?
Sure.
Okay.
This is from which one should I do? Oh, here is in honor of what Dan just played for us. Here is from Noel Heiteman. He's our number two finalist right here. He's it presents an exuberantly and unapologetically nation-building Miss South Carolina. The Americans are so the future. I like our nation in that because we built up education here, over there, and everywhere, the U.S. should help out. Some people don't believe in countries such as our South Africa and our Iraq. They should believe. Personally, I do. And the U.S. should believe, should help. Our maps for South Africa and Iraq will be unable able to help Asian education to have that. And so I like the U.S.
Oh, man. That was – that sounded like – were there that many words in the original one?
Yep. There's 68 words if you include the us, the two us.
That was remarkable.
68 pearls strung
exactly.
So many ways.
Mo Rocca with I think one of the better website names out there right now, Mo Rocca 180. Keep working. You're going to get up there to AC 360 territory real soon, Mo.
I'm going to get up to Mo Rocca 365 because I don't take 5 days off.
All right. Thank you for coming on the old BPP.
Coming up on the Bryant Park Project, very excited, Mark Olson will join us in the studio for a little bit of talk, a live interview, a live performance as well. This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News.
joy in sweet moments to be found in this world. We know they'll come to an end, just how makes our hearts hurt. Salvation.
Welcome back to the Bryant Park Project. Allison Stewart with Luke Burbank, and you're listening to the sounds of Mark Olson. He's one of the founding members of the band The Jayhawks, and for years he helped create some rich and sweet rocking country music or countrified rock music. Mark left the band to work with his then significant other, Victoria Williams. Then Mark Olson went solo in more ways than one. The results can be heard on the collection of very honest songs about self-discovery and tough times called Salvation Blues. Let's listen a little bit more of the song.
Salvation Blues, and these blues will help us all. There's all kinds of death trips roaming in these hills.
Salvation Blues also happens to be the name of a documentary making its debut in New York City tonight. The author of the CD and the subject of the documentary, Mark Olson, joins us in the studio. Mark, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having us in here.
So, from every review I've read and every article and interview you've done, this just seems to be as an extraordinarily personal record for you, is it?
Yeah, well, it's more along the lines that over the years, I always had an idea of what I wanted to write about, and that was about, you know, what goes on in a person's life, getting to a moment of a decision being made, the path they choose. It's like, you know, it's a subject of many novels and movies and things like that, but it interests me how a person gets on the road they're taking in life. And, you know, you see that in your friends, you see that in people you just meet, and that's sort of what interests me about writing, and I was able to finally do that after having gone through some personal experiences. I was never able to really get that across in song, but I think I did this time, so.
You did something I think a lot of people wish they could do or have the courage to do, that let's get lost thing. I'm just going to take off.
Well,
I'm going to go to Europe. I'm going to try to figure out.
I stayed with my aunt in America, and we were more along the lines of, let's get you a job.
Oh. Because you've been on my couch, is that why?
Well, she had three kids. She's only 5 years older than me and a really good friend of mine, my aunt. And so we kind of got me going down the road of getting that together. But music kept calling, and I had friends who were writers. He writes kind of his name's John Williams, and he writes sort of Raymond Chandler-esque novels in Wales, set in Wales. And they asked me to come over there. They'd booked shows with me over there. And I stayed with them for a month, and they just really convinced me by the way they were working that I was going to work again in the musical field. So I gave it a
You thought about giving
yeah,
up for
doing
a while.
Doing something else for a while. Because I'd been working hard. I'd made 4 records in Europe and had toured for the past 4 or 5 years, 5 months out of the years there. So I had been working at it really hard, and I'd come home and I didn't have really much going on here. So that was where my aunt thought.
What would you have done for a job?
Well, I was signed up for a school. I have some education, so I was going to finish that.
But I mean, did you have any thoughts on ultimately what you wanted to do?
Well, I it was just in the newspaper here. I was going to do the same thing someone did in the Philharmonic, which was the EMT walk of life. When you're a musician, you like to, you know, get out there and do something. You're going fast down the highway, and hopefully you like to think of your music as helping people. So that's what I was drawn to through a deep psychoanalysis. I found out I wanted to be an EMT.
Let me just tell you that before I did this show, I had kind of a job where I could set my own schedule a little bit. And going to a thing every day sucks. I think you should totally made the right call to stay in
Well,
music.
we go to our music every day, believe me.
But at least you don't have to do it at 6 in the morning.
Yeah, so well, 4 in the morning sometimes. We catch planes and stuff. And people don't know that, play late. And we get up at 4 and catch planes and things like that. So it's we don't sleep in anymore. When we were young, we did, but now.
Well, we got you here a little bit early.
No way.
To perform. Introduce who else is in the studio and tell us what you're going to play.
Ingunn Ringvold is going to sing and play the drum, and she's from Norway, and she's a very beautiful singer. She sang her whole life. And this is Michele Gossett, who plays the violin from Brescia, Italy. And I've toured with them in Europe. Like I said, I made mm-hmm. records over there, and so they're my band, along with a fellow from Los Angeles named Jimmy who wears a funny hat. So if you come to the show, should we do it?
Please.
Tears from Above.
Oh, let mercy, oh, let grace, that
I cannot call. May it come by this place. May it fall like tears from above. May it fall like tears from above. The sun will hide his face. My rooms will be a prison. My work will be taken away by the night. Darkness and light are at us like a mole. Darkness and light are at us like a mole. Oh, let mercy, oh, let grace. I cannot call, may it come by this place. May it fall like tears from above. May it fall like tears from above. The rain that falls in the morning will keep the doves from the sky. The green grass is plenty, green grass becomes knee high. Darkness and light are at us like a mole. Darkness and light are at us like a mole. Oh, let mercy, oh, let grace. I cannot call, may it come by this place. May it fall like from above, may it fall like tears from above. May it fall like tears from above. May it fall like.
Oh, that was tremendously beautiful.
We enjoyed it.
Ah, so Mark, we're going to ask you to stick around. Okay. I want to talk to you a little bit more about your documentary coming up. We've got Mark Olson in the studio. We do want to take 90 seconds to get you caught up on the news of the day. Here's Matt Martinez.
This is NPR.
Thanks, Allison. It was a day of reports today. It is a day of reports today. A new government report says that 13 of the 18 benchmarks set to measure the troop surge in Iraq have not been met. A panel report on the Virginia Tech shooting says school administrators could have acted faster and saved lives. And a report by the Commerce Department says that the economy grew at its strongest pace in more than a year. And Phoenix set a record. With a reading of 113 degrees yesterday, Phoenix had a record of 29 days with temperatures 110 degrees or hotter. That's in a single year. Pretty amazing. More on these stories are online all the time at npr.org. I'm Matt Martinez. Back to you, Luke. Allison.
Thank you so much, Matt. You're listening to the Bryant Park Project. Luke Burbank and Allison Stewart, very happy to have Mark Olson and company in our studio talking about your new record, Salvation Blues. Oh, you've been touring with it all summer. Your tour schedule, Mark, is insane. In the next, I think, month, you're going to Kansas, Oklahoma, Vermont, California. Keeping up a schedule like that, which is grueling enough, and then singing all these really personal songs, does it ever take its toll on you?
No, the singing, is that's where I can lose myself in the music, and that's fine. There is the meetings of strangers in truck stops that is strange. You know, just people think I'm trying
the
to butt in.
That's always strange for all of us, I think.
Because I'm in a hurry, because of the schedule, I'm in a little bit of a hurry. People get upset sometimes and say, he's trying to butt in line, you know, things like that. But That's about it. We get a little tired. We don't eat regular meals, but that's okay. But we get those moments, you know, late at night. You're all of a sudden you're in Toronto. You can sit out on the street, have a beer, relax, and laugh. So it has its a lot of plus sides, really.
What's the best kind of show? Is it when there's a lot of people, or is it when there's like 10 people and they're really into it? I mean, what makes it?
If it's a numbers thing, the best show would be about 100 people who are there just really knowing the songs and relating to the different parts in the music. And that does happen at various times because they're picking up on a particular solo or a particular singing session part. And that's the best kind. You have your, you know, more rock shows where you're just kind of rocking out and people are going rah, rah, but they're not really listening to the different parts. So I enjoy more about the 100 people who are sitting and listening.
Is it hard when you show up somewhere and maybe everybody there doesn't know the music and they're talking to their friends and you're like singing about your life and you just got to power through?
Well, let me tell you about that. Now, I used to be married to Victoria Williams. I'm still a very good friend of hers and I live right by her. And that was horrible. We were in a band together and sometimes she has a very soft voice, but it's almost Billie Holiday-esque. And it's just gorgeous, but she can't sing over that kind of thing. So I was the guy that would do that in our band. When they started talking, I'd get in there and I'd just bang out, you know, these songs. And that was sort of, I kind of enjoyed that. Okay, they're talking over Vic. Here I go. I'm going to take them on head on. So it's sort of like, you know, and I don't ever say, oh, stop talking or anything. We just go about our job. We put our head down and do it. And that happens on occasion. And that's your bar crowd. And there's nothing you can really do about that. You know, I would say 1/3 to 1/4, you might get some. No, maybe 1/4 to 1/8, that will happen, and it is discouraging. And I'd rather take them on than sit there and watch somebody I like, you know, have to deal with it. That's singing softer than me. I can sing loud, so it is a deal though on occasion.
Tonight's the big night for you. Obviously, you have shows all summer long, but tonight is the night when your documentary.
I didn't go out and say I wanted to make a documentary, but this guy, Ray Foley, has made a documentary.
90 hours of footage, is that true?
Well, he followed us around. We came here for 2 weeks, and he followed us around.
How was that?
It was a little weird, but we all started to enjoy it. We all started to talk like we're being filmed constantly. And, you know, so that was...
I've been doing that for like 31 years.
So when the camera's off, you go, where's the camera? Because I'm acting again.
I'm about to be fabulous and say something pithy.
Yeah, really
where are
funny.
You?
But we took the best part of it was Ray just had some people filming us, and he was watching. He was kind of very encouraging about the thing, and we're actually staying at his house. But he took us out to Coney Island on a rainy day, and that seemed to be where most of the footage is actually from that day, going out to Coney Island and walking and talking. Various topics.
So it's a day in the life, a little slice of life of a musician in New York City.
Of a musician, yeah. That is basically the gist of it is that I performed in Europe for many years, but now I'm just coming back to America to try to have a run at it again. That's the basic idea. And we discuss things, family things. Mm-hmm. Just we have some laughs too. It's kind of funny in some ways, so it's good.
Can we talk you into one more song?
Okay.
What's this going to be?
Why don't we do National Express? Once I lost my self-respect, I was stranded in blue and all by myself. Then my love came up to me. I want to ride with you by the sea. Oh, my love. These traveling blues got a hold of me. It makes no difference what you do or where you'll stay when you come home. Who will know your name? A gypsy by the footbridge, standing in the rain. Here comes the National Express. Here comes the National Express. Here comes the National Express. Station was empty then. Light bulbs were broken, announcements grim. Children to follow how they talk. Children to follow where they walk. Where's my home? How could I lose this in a day? It makes no difference what you do or where you'll stay when you come home. Who will know your name? A gypsy by the footbridge, standing in the rain. Here comes the National Express. Here comes the National Express. Here comes the National Express. Ancient survivor from a parish far away, with a dream they all share. Birds fly through the stations. Here comes the National Express. Here comes the National Express. Here comes the National Express. Here comes the National.
Mark Olson, thank you so much for joining
us.
Thanks to everybody
here
for coming into the studio at the Bryant Park Project. If you'd like to see Mark's performance, you should go straight to our blog, npr.org/Bryant Park. We'll get the video up there as soon as possible. Thanks again.
Thanks for having us.
I don't know why this isn't a music show. It's so much better than when we do the news.
I'm in. Anytime.
Thanks, guys, for coming.
Nice mix of news and music.
Hey, that's good. Mark Olson approved. The Bryant Park Project.
And a nice segue. Hey, we're going to be talking about the GA report about Iraq and coming up in the next hour. Right?
Also, some controversy swirling around To Catch a Predator. Allison, we have another hour of the Bryant Park Project coming
up. I'm in.
After this.
I'm ready.
How fancy. Well, thank you for listening. Stick around. It's going to get even more interesting. It's the Bryant Park Project from the NPR News.
And your light till we do something good. In the morning, the things we once did, overboard, false friends ignored. All these longings and the gifts.
From NPR News in New York, this is the Bryant Park Project with Allison Stewart and Luke Burbank.
My goodness, it's the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. We're going where no BPP show has gone before.
into the second hour. I'm Luke Burbank. You're Allison Stewart.
I'm Al Stewart, and I think I'll stick around for the next hour, if that's okay with you?
I think it's actually in your contract. I had them put that in, because I did not want to have to do it myself.
Knew I should have read the last page. Coming up, we're going to have the Bryant Park Project Good Sport. That would be Bill Wolf, a.k.a. Mr. Allison Stewart. Give us a preview of what to watch this weekend in the world of sports.
We're also going to talk about this controversy going on with the show To Catch a Predator. It's a Dateline NBC show. If you've watched 5 seconds of television in the last 6 months, you have seen this program. We're going to talk about what you may not know about it.
We're also going to look at some of the most emailed articles and most viewed around. Yeah. Dan's got a favorite, doesn't he?
Yeah. Two words. Fried clam. Most of Dan Pashman's life revolves around food, the getting of food, the thinking about food.
Obtaining of food.
Yeah, and we're gonna have the most and talk about a great piece from NPR's Joe Palca about perfect pitch. We're going to hear some of that. First, though, let's get down to the big story. More not-so-great news for the White House with regards to Iraq. Wait, is this yesterday's script? No, it's just every day. There's the same kind of thing seems to be happening. The General Accounting Office is going to have a secret session with Congress today to go over a report that it's prepared on how things are going in Iraq. The assessment, not good. The Washington Post has a preview of the report in today's paper. Basically, they say of the 18 benchmarks, these are the kind of measure of if things are working, of the 18, only 3 benchmarks are being met.
The Post calls the GAO report, quote, strikingly negative. On the military front, it says the plan to secure Baghdad hasn't really worked, and that while U.S. soldiers are a little safer, Iraqi citizens are still getting killed at the same rate, and that Iraqi forces not ready to handle things on their own.
Politically, the report is pretty grim, too. It finds that various folks at the table, the Sunni, the Shia, Kurds, they can't get along enough to really approve any kind of meaningful policies. The White House is expected to say that the report is sort of bunk because Congress told the General Accounting Office, which is kind of their, you know, checker upper mm-hmm. agency, they told them that these benchmarks needed to just be pass-fail. And there was no kind of saying some things are working. So the White House says there are things that may be listed as failing, but actually there's some progress. It's not getting covered in this.
Now, the president's spokesman said yesterday that everybody should just simmer down and wait for the big September 15th White House report, which will involve the U.S. military brass and the U.S. ambassador to Iraq, before deciding whether or not things are working. So that's it for today's big story. Now here's Matt Martinez with the rest of the news.
This is NPR.
Thanks, guys. Good morning, everyone. A new report says that Virginia Tech officials could have saved lives if they had quickly issued a campus-wide warning that 2 students had been shot to death in a dormitory and their killer was on the loose. It took administrators more than 2 hours to get a strongly worded email out to the students and staff. Sung-Wee Cho had time to leave the dorm, mail a letter, and then return to the classroom building where he chained the doors shut and killed 31 more people, including himself. Pakistan's exiled former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto says that President General Pervez Musharraf will step down as head of Pakistan's military. Bhutto is said to be negotiating a power-sharing deal with Musharraf, but a government spokesman says that Musharraf has not yet decided whether to step down as army chief. The government says the U.S. economy grew at its strongest pace in more than a year during the spring. Credit goes to solid improvements in international trade and business investment, which offset continued weakness in the housing market. Rescuers at the Utah mine, Crandall Canyon Mine, are expected to break through to a chamber today where 6 missing miners may have taken refuge. They've been drilling a 7th hole to lower a robotic camera into. U.S. Mine Safety Chief Kevin Strickland says that the rescue workers will continue searching for the man as long as there's a possibility that they're alive, but he says that that likelihood decreases each day. Firefighters in Greece are trying to gain control of the last remaining major fire. They're still concerned that a new heat wave and winds over the weekend could feed smaller blazes. The countrywide fire has killed 64 people and burned nearly 500,000 acres. The founder of legendary New York punk rock club CBGB's has died. Hilly Kristal ran the club that helped make the Ramones, Blondie, and Talking Head stars. He was 75 years old. And another toy recall, Toys R Us has recalled 27,000 crayon and paint sets made in China because the packaging of the wooden box contains lead. So does some of the watercolor paint in that box. No injuries have been reported from the use of the Imaginarium wooden coloring cases. The news is always online at npr.org. I'm Matt Martinez. Back to you, Luke and Allison.
Thank you, Matthew. You know, it's not easy to set up a presidential debate, and it's not easy to actually get everyone to show up. You kind of need a critical mass.
I tried.
Yeah. How'd that go at your
apartment? The Stewart debates, not so much. Me and my cat, Sonny Liston, debating health care.
Although some of the cat fancy politics that you guys got into, I thought it was some of the best feline-driven debates. No, but what you have to do is it seems like you have to sort of get one kind of big name to show up, and then the other big names have to show up. Otherwise, though, there are all kinds of little sort of side debates that have been going on mm-hmm. in places like Iowa and New Hampshire.
My living room.
Yeah, actually one that did get pretty good turnout was the Lance Armstrong moderated mm-hmm. debate. Melissa Etheridge, I think, did a debate a while ago. And we were wondering sort of what was up with these, you know, how much effect they really have on the race, and if they're just kind of, you know, if these people are like Lance Armstrong are just spinning their wheels, or if this actually in any way affects real policy.
Did you say Lance Armstrong spinning his wheels?
Oh my gosh, that was the best pun of all time. Is that a pun or is that a...
It's close to a pun.
Well, okay, whatever. Punnery, by the way, is the lowest form of humor except for mime. It goes miming and then puns. Anyway, we managed to track down Paul Kane. He's a congressional correspondent for WashingtonPost.com. Hi, Paul.
Hey, how are you guys?
Good, man. Thanks for coming on. Could you just give us a rundown of a few of these kind of mini debates, maybe some of the odder ones that have been going on and sort of how it's been going?
Sure thing. Now, just in terms of puns, I've been doing a lot of Larry Craig coverage for the last So, you know, you use spinning your wheels and this with Lance Armstrong. It's just much easier to do when you're doing Larry Craig stories, you really have to be careful of all the language you use because of puns and double entendre.
Everything sounds vaguely dirty, right?
You know, really raw. God.
Naughty, naughty boy.
Exactly.
Oh, wait, that was
exactly.
Larry Craig.
Even, you know, the ethics probe becomes, oh, my God, did I just say that on there? Yeah, well, what has been going on is that they really, all the different groups, from lesbian gay activist groups with Melissa Etheridge that you mentioned, at every union and their local sister wants to hold their own version of a debate or a forum. There was one sponsored by the AFL-CIO out in Las Vegas earlier this year. There are union forums that want to be held in Iowa and New Hampshire. And then this week on Monday, there was the Lance Armstrong, essentially the cancer forum. What happened was last week, maybe 10 days ago, Barack Obama essentially sort of reached a point where he said enough is enough and became the sort of first presidential candidate to say, look, I got to get a grasp on my campaign schedule. I can't keep going to every single group's forum. And, you know, I'm very sorry about that, but he has declared that he will attend every single official debate sponsored by the Democratic National Committee. Now, they've already had, I think, four of those official Democratic National Committee debates, and I believe they're going to have something along the lines of six, seven, eight more. So it's not as if Obama is ducking anybody and ducking debates. It's just that he really has felt like this is just starting to become an overwhelming topic in which you're not doing any real campaigning and meeting voters, et cetera. You're just standing up on a platform, rehashing every single thing that you've said.
So who is it who ends up showing up for these, like, you know, busboys of Waffle House in Decorah, Iowa, decide they're going to have a debate? I guess it's just like Tom Tancredo.
It depends on which – it really depends on the sort of star power of the person. I mean, they all showed up for the Melissa Etheridge debate, and most of them, you know, including Clinton and Edwards, two of the top three, showed up for Lance Armstrong. I mean, Lance Armstrong has, I think, supplanted Bono as the celebrity that politicians on Capitol Hill and throughout Washington love the most. You know, I'm not sure that the Irish rock star knows that, and if he is told of this, he may come rushing to Washington and spend a few weeks here to muscle Armstrong aside. But, you know, who if you are the Waffle House in Ames, Iowa, you're probably not going to get everybody. You might get Dennis Kucinich, but
now he's a vegan. I don't think scares them all.
Although he does, he is a hostess there on Thursdays and Saturdays, so he might just actually be there.
There must be some debates that you almost have to show up. I'm guessing the MTV MySpace debate is one of those that you probably don't want to say no to.
There are, and you know, the Republicans are going through this on their side with the whole CNN YouTube debate, where some of them are trying to say, you know, I'm above this. What is this sort of form of debate? But you know, there's this growing backlash even among their conservative online activists, who are, don't number nearly as many as the left-leaning online activists. But there are some that are sort of so unique that you probably do have to show up, because, you know, and MTV MySpace is probably going to be one of those. You know, Obama will definitely, I don't actually know this for certain, but knowing the politics of Obama, he will definitely be there for that debate, because right now that's where a lot of his base of support is coming from, is online, the online community. So he would definitely, I think, would be there for that debate.
Given you cover Congress for WashingtonPost.com, Paul, I want to move this a little bit forward. We're all going for Labor Day weekend, and then everybody's coming back to work, including the Congress. It's very nice of them. What's the big issue that they're going to face the first 3 weeks?
Okay. Well, after we get done chasing Larry Craig around, and sadly, that's sort of it, assuming he does not retire or resign in the next few days. You know, that first day back, first full day back, it's going to be that way. It's going to be, you know, right, sort of annoying and funny and horrible all at one time. But then, you know, the Iraq war is becoming the big focus. You're going to see in the next few days, the first week back, the official presentation of a GAO report on benchmarks for accountability, which we had a story on, like in a sort of early draft in today's Washington Post, showing that they've only met 3 out of 18 benchmarks that Congress, the Iraqi government, has only met 3 out of 18 benchmarks. Well, that report will be officially unveiled next week when Congress gets back. So that's going to, you know, that'll be sort of the first, that's the warm-up pitch for the rest of the month in terms of the Iraq war. And then the following week, beginning September 10th, you'll have the real presentation of what we've been calling the Petraeus Report.
But that's not really accurate, right? It should be called the White House Report?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. who knows, really? Then, and now we're hearing that Petraeus himself will not actually write up a report himself. He will come to Congress and give his views of where things are, and, you know, now it's sounding like the report itself may be written by Robert Gates, the defense secretary. That is all still sort of up in the air and a little bit unclear. But that issue is going to really consume Congress in that week, Monday, September 10th through the 14th. And then in the following weeks after that, the Senate at some point is going to bring up their defense authorization bill. That was the bill, the underlying bill that they were debating back in July when they had the round-the-clock, all-night debate on withdrawing from Iraq, and that's going to come up again because they have to pass that bill. So that's going to be the trigger, the big trigger in the Senate for a real Donnybrook over what next Iraq.
Sadly, also, that defense spending is not going to be nearly as laden with entendre as the Larry Craig story. But you're still going to need to cover it, Paul, even if it's less fun. That's what you do.
I know.
I don't even want to think about the stakeout. I covered Congress for a while, and when there's during the William Jefferson, stuff, you get these. You know, people sort of look down on the people who cover Paris Hilton, you know, the reporters and the sort of scrum. But, you know, hell hath no fury like one of these congressional stakeouts when you know the guy's going to go from his office or the woman's going to go from their office to this one committee meeting. And the congressional, TV radio department says you can basically be in this one place with this one kind of shot. And it is, like, fierce.
Well, it becomes – Jefferson took the approach or has taken the approach at times when he is that flashpoint in the news, where he just simply accepts that there are going to be reporters that are going to follow him, and he will walk out of his office, and he will not answer a single question, despite no matter how many times a print, radio, TV reporter asks a question. He just keeps on walking.
He's a singular vision, and he may have had money to deposit in his freezer.
And he likes that Unk song.
Walk it out. Paul Kane, congressional correspondent for the WashingtonPost.com. Thank you, Paul.
Thanks, Paul.
All right. Thanks, guys. I'll see you. Bye.
Hey, Allie, coming up in just a few minutes, talking about Perfect Pitch and also the controversy behind To Catch a Predator.
That's all coming up on the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. Welcome back to the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. I'm Allison Stewart.
And I'm Luke Burbank. Coming up, we'll talk sports. Now, I just think this is inappropriate. They wrote with Allison's better half.
I was going to say at least my hairier half.
Which is saying something, because you got a mane on you, lady.
I'm talking about my head.
Oh, my. See, I thought I was going to be the first one to get us sanctioned by the FCC, but I guess that was going to be you. We're going to talk about some of the controversy around Dateline NBC. Right now, though, it's time to run down some of the most looked-at emailed stories with our fearless producers, Dan Pashman, MJ Davis, Matt Martinez.
Who's up first?
I think this would be...
Dan's still hustling in here,
so let's have MJ Davis kick us off with... Where'd you get this story from?
I actually got this from NPR.com. It's one of the most emailed stories.
I think it's .org.
.org. Ah, don't fire me.
Seriously. NPR.com is an adult site, and I don't think we want to send people
there. Are a lot of .coms today. Sorry, guys. Okay, so it's called Tiny Runner Completes Epic Journey in China, and there was an 8-year-old who ran 2,212 miles in 55 days as a celebration for the Beijing Olympics. She ran 40 miles a day. Her dad made her get up at 2:30 every morning while he rode an electric bike beside her. She went through 20 pairs of
shoes. He didn't even use like a bike
shoes.
That he had to pedal.
No.
Like that should be an indication, by the way. If you need an electric bike to keep up with your 8-year-old's running,
maybe she's running too much.
Here, I want you to hear how cute she is though, and then imagine her running 40 miles. Can we play a clip from the piece? I want to run to the moon. I love running because it's really fun for me. Now what you're hearing her sing is I Love Beijing's Tiananmen Square. It's a children's communist song.
Oh, stop.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Seriously?
I love running, especially when the government's at my mother's house.
And this, and clearly she's never been to school because she's been running so much because she thinks she can run to the moon.
Right. And her father is actually, he's being investigated for child abuse right now. And I should give credit where credit is due. This was a piece by Louisa Lim.
Ah, Louisa Lim. Excellent, excellent correspondent in Beijing for NPR.
Dan Pashman's most
emailed.
Hey, guys.
Is kind of meta.
I can't believe that you guys are already on to the fact that I really like to talk about food.
Is it because you have
didn't take long,
four
huh?
like giant popcorn tins at your desk every day? I don't know. That tipped us off.
Yeah, well, there's this article in NewYorkTimes.com, which is the most emailed article on the site, but also independently of that, was emailed to me by three different people.
That's why I said it was meta.
It's right. It made it an easy choice for my part here, but it's all about fried clams. I spent 6 years living in New England. My mom's family is from New England. It's a big New England thing, fried clams. As the article says, fried clams are to New England what barbecue is to the South. And this guy basically took a road trip through New England to find the best fried clams. And he and I share a similar frustration, which is that it's hard to find big-bellied fried clams. They're
sure.
getting smaller and smaller.
Really frustrating.
And those aren't as good. And this guy searched all around to find the best, juiciest, most delicious fried clams. And there's an audio clip of him on the website, if you guys want to hear that.
Sure.
This was the third time we had eaten fried clams in 2 hours. And when I went up to the window, I looked up, and there was what I was looking for. It said, big-bellied clams available upon request. And a very interesting interchange happened when I asked for them. The woman looked rather puzzled, and she said, are you sure? And I said, yes. And she said, you're only going to get about 9. I said, that's perfectly fine. And she kept on trying to dissuade me from getting them, and I persisted, and I got them. And then what came through the window was this big, beautiful pint of these large clams with a belly so big that the batter was chipping off. I went through them in about 10 minutes. It was very easy to do that. They were so luscious and plump.
Oh, yeah. Are you guys as hungry as I am?
Oh, you looked mildly turned on, Dan. I know. That clip. I don't know if that's good.
What do you mean mildly?
Disturbing.
Oh, that would be Matt Martinez chirping in. Matt, you had to get a most today.
I did have to get a most.
What
and
do you
actually,
bring to the party?
Well, fortunately for all of you, I have Kevin Federline on my Google alerts, and so it brings up the one of the top emailed stories at TMZ.com, which has been the Britney Spears targeted in the child abuse investigation, which is actually hovering between number one and number two at People. The only thing beating out People or Britney at People mm-hmm. is the Owen Wilson story.
Right.
And I will say that I have been a fan of Kevin Federline's Papa Zhao song. Remember that Papa
sure.
Zhao song he did? Gosh, I should have pulled
who
that.
Can forget it.
I feel awful about not having that. And so ever since and I've actually been a pretty big fan of him because it was so awful. It was such an awful, awful piece of music that I fell in love with it.
Well, the So Bad It's Good category?
So Bad It's Good category,
well, the thing that's
yeah.
amazing about the fall of Britney Spears is that Kevin Federline seems totally be the rational one and, like, he's the one you would definitely trust the kids
I know.
With.
It's a Shakespearean turn. I know. It's we just didn't see this one coming.
A two for most emailed from TMZ and from People magazine, KFED. Matt Martinez, thank you.
You're very
and
welcome.
Thanks to Dan Pashman. Thanks to MJ Davis.
The most emailed story from NPR News yesterday was at number one. It's at number two today, but, you know, maybe after this, it'll shoot back up. It's about the ability to ID musical notes exactly without any other point of reference. Now, if you're someone who can sing a note spot on, don't thank your third grade piano teacher. Maybe thank your parents.
When an orchestra tunes before a concert, everyone tunes to a single note, A. But A can actually be different frequencies. In the United States, A is typically 440 vibrations per second, or 440 hertz. But there's a range. According to Gitcher, the Berlin Philharmonic tunes to an A at 446 hertz. And some orchestras specializing in early music tune to an A as low as 415 hertz. And 415 is right where G sharp would be if you tuned to one of the higher pitched A's.
So perhaps people with absolute pitch have learned or incorporated this spread of tuning frequencies into the cluster that they call A.
Now that story is reported by NPR science correspondent Joe Palca, who joins us on the phone. So Joe, how do you feel about having the most emailed story at NPR?
It's a great honor.
Oh, actually, you're in the studio. You're not on the phone. Fantastic.
I don't like to correct you, but yes, I'm in a very comfy studio here.
Oh, correct on, please.
Believe me, it wouldn't be the first time. This is why you sent out an email the other day, Joe, within NPR going, does anyone know anyone who has perfect pitch?
That's right. Well, and more to the point, this is why I told everyone I know to send an email mailing this story around so that it'd be the most emailed story.
It worked.
It's great. That's why we do – it's called networking. You get, you know – win friends and influence people.
Well, so the question, I guess, is why is it important for these scientists to understand the genetics behind perfect pitch? Isn't it just kind of a neat party trick?
Yeah, I'd put it in the neat party trick department. No, I mean,
I think that's a great way of characterizing Western civilization. Learning about how the how things work is a neat party trick.
But, no. I don't mean knowing about perfect pitch. I mean having perfect pitch.
Oh, having perfect pitch. Well, I mean the question is, actually, I have to be careful here because there's a huge discussion in certain musical circles about what's perfect pitch. Is it being able to sing a note exactly, or is it being able to identify a note exactly? This is a study where people were asked, if you hear a note, can you identify that note on a keyboard? So it's pitch naming, I guess, is what they're talking about. And the reason this is interesting is people are trying to figure out, well, what is it about the brain that allows some people to do this and others not? And is there anything we can learn about speech perception, language perception, just perception in general by knowing the genetics of this?
Is where you live, does that play into it at all? I mean, many languages are tonal.
Yeah, it seems to be. I mean, I was talking with somebody about this, and I haven't seen the studies, but there was something not so long ago about how there was more people with perfect pitch in China where they use a tonal language than you would in the United States. I think this whole thing is kind of, I think the thing that I like about it is that there's some people who hear tones the way we see colors. So if I say that's red, nobody's going to disagree it's red. But that's a frequency too. That's light reflected into our eyes at a particular frequency. So there's no reason that we couldn't have developed a naming structure for musical notes just as we have for tones. I mean, for colors.
Now, there, Joe,
stop you on that one.
How's your pitch, by the way?
Oh, this is fantastic. I went and took the test myself, and there actually people fall into two bins. Either you have this and you get like 70 or 80%, or you're completely guessing, not a clue. And so I found out, I took a lot of music, and I found I'm in the not a clue category.
No.
Oh, no.
Were you crushed?
No, I know I don't have perfect pitch. I've got, I have many fine attributes, but...
Yes, Joe.
Yes, I my life will continue just fine without having perfect pitch.
One of our producers who shall... will remain nameless, but it rhymes with MJ. Mm-hmm. Her boyfriend has perfect pitch, and she's a really good singer, but she says she's constantly finding out that there's a difference between being a good singer and having perfect pitch.
Right. Well, okay, and there's a difference between being able to hear two different pitches, discriminate pitches, and there's a difference between being able to give intervals. So if you can sing a third and a fifth above a tone, that's perfect. They call that perfect relative pitch, and it's good to have that because if someone gets you started on the right note and you've got perfect relative pitch, then the rest of the thing will be in tune. It's when people can't hear when they're going off tune that you begin to like cringe if you've got something relating or closely related to perfect pitch.
Well, if you want to hear the entire story,
you should.
And email it.
Email it to 10 friends,
send
like a chain letter.
Tell your friends. I mean, we could make this the most emailed story ever in the history of NPR.
I think Joe's gone power hungry.
I know.
Come on.
Absolute why email would I be here corrupts
if, why
absolutely.
Would I not be here if I didn't want the power? We can do this. Come on, America. Let's do it.
NPR science correspondent.
Get out there.
Joe Palca, the story is called.
Turn his mic off, please.
Thank California scientists search for perfect pitch.
Thank you, Joe. Wait, is that? Geez, Louise, he is really kind of losing his mind with this. All right, let's get it back on track with some news headlines. How is your pitch, Matthew?
This is NPR.
My pitch is pretty awful.
That's
pretty
cool.
Awful. Right. I can do a good version of You Are My Sunshine, which I used to test the mics before the show.
I hope we recorded that.
Yes.
Well, give us the news headlines.
Okay, I sure will. Taliban militants have released the final 7 South Korean captives that they've been holding. It brings an end to the 6-week hostage drama. Congressional auditors say that the Iraqi government has failed to meet the vast majority of political and military goals laid out by Congress. The AP is reporting that a GAO report says that at least 13 of the 18 benchmarks that would measure the surge of U.S. troops in Iraq are unfulfilled. A new report says that Virginia Tech officials could have saved lives if they had quickly issued a campus-wide warning that 2 students had been shot to death in a dormitory and their killer was on the loose. A teen who posted a nude photo of his younger ex-girlfriend on her MySpace page was sentenced to 30 days in jail. 19-year-old Anthony Rich pleaded no contest Tuesday to child abuse and attempted child abuse.
And the government says the economy grew during the spring at the strongest pace in more than a year. The Commerce Department reports that the gross domestic product, which is the broadest measure of economic health, expanded at an annual rate of 4% in the April to June quarter. That's significantly higher than the 3.4% rate that the government had initially estimated about a month ago. I'm Matt Martinez. The news is always online at npr.org. Now back to you, Luke and Allison.
Thank you, Matt Martinez.
You're welcome.
Coming up on a holiday weekend here, some people will just simply chillax at the beach or maybe at a barbecue. I personally, I'm going to be at a yard sale on Saturday, while my husband will likely be watching some sort of sporting event on the TV. Let's find out what's in store for the sports fan in my life. Former ESPN producer, my husband, Bill Wolf, will get him on the horn to help us sports challenge listeners of the Bryant Park Project.
We're dialing for dollars.
He promised he'd be here this week.
Yeah, we've had problems with this in the past, but... Oh, that's not
good.
One
more time.
I'm going to redial, and I'm also going to apologize to the staff for spilling that huge cup of coffee.
Yeah, that's pretty bad.
It was kind of bound to happen.
You spilled vitamin water last hour.
I know.
This hour.
It's okay, MJ. Thank you.
I think we have to, like, put you in a full body, plastic body
stocking. No, I need a sippy cup. Okay, we've dialed it again. What do you think, Manoli? Is it ringing?
He's probably sitting there. He promised he'd be in his office when we did this.
Yeah. Hmm. I'm beginning to rethink my theory about dialing it on the air.
Being yeah.
Two out of two times, it's been a complete disaster.
You guys want to? Do you want to just dial them in normally?
All
okay,
right,
you guys
fine.
Do it. Okay.
Every time I try to do something fancy, it blows up.
Okay, the big subject we're going to talk about, because I know he's very, very excited about the pennant race. Mm-hmm. Also going to talk a little bit about Team USA basketball.
Yeah.
We may talk.
Let me tell you about Team USA basketball for a moment, Allie, if I can. The pride is back.
Well, that's the point.
I was watching it the other day, and I have gone from when I was a kid and the Dream Team played, that was like with Jordan and
Bird. That was a thing.
They would just destroy people. Then, most recently, it's gotten where you get used to seeing these Brazil, who are these teams, like whipping the U.S., but now you turn it on and they're winning by 50 again, which
and
makes
at this
me feel
point,
better as an American.
Bill Wolf, how does it make you feel as an American that Team USA is winning?
Proud.
Hi, darling.
Nonplussed. I don't know. It makes me feel fine, I suppose. It makes me think that the basketball business, which, you know, the top of the basketball business is the NBA, and then it goes all. It's a business all the way down to high schools, and even before that, that the basketball business got embarrassed by losing to Brazil and Argentina and Greece and Spain and all of these teams, which are good teams, but they're not supposed to beat us. And so, I think they woke up. I think American basketball woke up and realized they had to do things differently in order to excel.
We sort of backed into this one. Explain to people what's going on with Team USA right now.
Well, there's a sort of a Western Hemisphere tournament here, the Tournament of the Americas, and it's a qualifying tournament for the Olympics in 2008. So you have to finish in the top two to qualify for the Olympic tournament in 2008. And the United States has just rolled over Puerto Rico and Uruguay and various other teams from this hemisphere, and they have qualified for the semifinals of this Western Hemisphere Cup of the Americas tournament. If they can win in the semifinals, then they will qualify for the Olympics. And, you know, we haven't won the Olympic gold medal in quite some time. Didn't win it in 2004 or in 2000. So that's what's going on. They're rolling teams. They're beating teams by 30, 40 points. Just absolutely destroying them. So that's what's going on. And a big intriguing game happens Thursday night tonight against Argentina. Argentina is probably the second best, after America, the second best producer of talent basketball-wise in the world. But a lot of their big talent isn't playing in this tournament. So on the face of it's a big game tonight. But I think America will stomp the brave Argentinians.
Let's talk baseball. Bud Selig says the current pennant race, we're having races that are legendary. So for someone who isn't following this, what does that mean?
You're not following this?
I got to admit, I'm not. I'm
wow.
Sorry.
Okay. Well, then let me try to explain. I don't know if they were legendary when Bud Selig said it, which was about 3 days ago, and they've gotten more legendary in certain areas and less legendary in others. There's six divisions in baseball, right? and the winner of each division gets into the playoffs.
Hang on a second. Luke just growled.
I'm sorry. No, I just continue, Bill. It's just
you're angry because of Seattle.
Yeah, the way it's getting less legendary. I don't want to interrupt your flow.
No, go ahead.
Basically, you've got these teams like the Yankees and Red Sox, which everyone else in the country is at least moderately interested in. Then you've got like a loser team like my guys from Seattle. They're receding into the background, and these teams like the Yankees and Red Sox are kind of getting more interest. Bill, I'm sorry. I interrupted. Keep going.
Luke, it's perfectly fine. I'm concerned about your self-loathing.
You and my therapist.
They're not a loser team. They're a nice team out there in Seattle. The reason these are legendary races is there are essentially six races going on, and just about all of them are close. It's really hard to tell who's going to win each race. Here come the nasty, mighty Yankees nipping at. You know, they've made up ground in the last 2 days on Boston, and Cleveland and Detroit are embroiled in something fairly serious. What Luke is upset about, I think, mm-hmm. I mean, that I know of, is that Seattle is playing the Los Angeles Angels, the team that plays in Anaheim, and not doing very well, so they're sort of slipping back. Yeah. Philadelphia is in the process of catching up to the Mets. The Cubs, the Milwaukee Brewers, and the mighty St. Louis Cardinals are embroiled in something very close in their division, and San Diego and Arizona are tied in their division with Los Angeles and Colorado, you know, close at their heels. So you just have all of these teams who are alive, and it's hard to know who's going to win, and that's what makes it legendary. When you have this many teams in close competition for the postseason, it is just excellent. And because it's baseball, it happens every day. So every single day it gets updated. It's not like basketball, which is sort of every other day or every third day, or football, which is once a week. It's baseball. So every single night some drama is unfolding somewhere in the baseball universe, and that, I think, is what Bud Selig means. And he's right. It's great this year. Baseball is having a fantastic year.
So, Bill, college football starts tonight. There's going to be 25 games over 5 days. Mm. How many college football fight songs do you have on your iPod?
On my iPod, I only have about six. There were just some that were unworthy or that religious beliefs restricted me from downloading.
All right.
I can't have USC's fight song on my iPod.
Plus, it's just stupid. Dun, 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 dun.
It's a pretty good one. It's USC and it's the enemy, and I can't have the enemy fight song.
You.
But I love a fight song, as
all right.
You know, darling.
We got a little bit of time left, about 30 seconds. Tell me what game I should watch if I want to get involved with college football this weekend.
I think you should probably watch Tennessee against Cal Berkeley, only because they're two good teams and the loser will really be damaged in their season. You know, they both are hopeful of being excellent. An early season loss is really a big deal in college football. The rest of the games look fairly lopsided, so I'm not sure. I mean, LSU is an excellent team, of course, and you should watch excellent teams.
Yep.
But the game that's going to be most interesting to see who wins is Tennessee versus California. Other than that, Missouri-Illinois, of course, is a border battle being played in St. Louis, and it's important to me, but I wouldn't expect the rest of the world to care.
I'll be over on Saturday, Bill. Is that cool?
Look forward to it.
But before I let you go, did you call the lady about the rug? Did we get our money back? Did you email her?
I emailed her yesterday.
Did she email you back?
No.
So there's still $1,300
right
on your credit card? Is that
an angry phone call from me right now. I want my money back.
$1,300 on a credit card, an impulse buy.
$1,400.
I didn't know that. All right. Hang up. Call the rug lady at ABC.
Well, I always feel
day.
Like I
thank
feel
you.
Like I
bye,
like
babe.
Your I
bye,
like
babe.
Your husband more than you like the guy, but I really like the guy.
I know. It's concerning.
Let me know if it gets rocky between you guys.
This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News.
I could be a shoulder to cry on.
You can't have
for him.
Welcome back to the Bryant Park Project. I'm Allison Stewart.
And I'm Chris Hansen from Dateline NBC. What are you doing here? All right, that was terrible. That was.
But you like doing that.
It's my favorite. It's seriously. I call my friend Kevin, Camaro Kevin, Seattle, and we'll just have like a 20-minute conversation where I'm just going, what are you doing here? That was a terrible impression. My name is actually Luke Burbank. Here's what the real thing sounds like.
For 3.5 days, men have been showing up at our beach house at the Jersey Shore.
Get down!
And one after the other, they've been arrested by officers from the Ocean County Prosecutor's Office.
And if you would have heard the clip we wanted to play, would have heard Chris Hansen talking to one of these fellas who showed up for a liaison, which didn't actually happen. If you have watched any TV in the last few months, you have you definitely seen this show. It's Dateline NBC, To Catch a Predator. And basically the producers lure guys, and it's always guys. I mean, theoretically they could be luring women, but it's always guys.
But it's always – and it's so interesting when you find it. It's like a rabbi was one guy, and then some other kid in college who looks like he never even spoke to a girl or a boy.
It's sad on so many levels. You know what? Though we've actually got the clip dialed up, and just to get a flavor of it, let's take a listen.
The parade of potential predators continues here in Ocean County, New Jersey.
Copy this. He matches the screen image we have of him. This is definitely our guy. This is Eichmann.
I love your car.
Thank you.
21-year-old John Donnelly is here after chatting online with a girl who told him she was 14. Just a few minutes into the chat, Eichmann04 tells her he's really horny.
I've never met anybody younger than like 18, so that just worried me. So
I understand. It's okay, though.
But as he's about to find out, everything isn't cool.
How's it going?
Pretty good. How you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm all right.
What's happened?
Yep, two.
I was just coming to meet this person.
Really? And who's that person?
Well, it's really good TV, okay? I mean, it's very popular. The only problem is, according to an article in next month's Esquire, is that a lot of it is maybe legally kind of shady, not to mention that it may have driven a guy who may or may not have broken the law to actually kill himself. Luke Dittrich wrote that article for Esquire, and he's on the show with us now. Hi, Luke.
Hi.
Amazing name, I just want to say for the record.
Right.
It's a testament to your personal character. Let's start actually with the story of this guy named Bill Conrat, who is it Conrat or Conrad?
Conrat.
Let's tell us a little bit about him.
Well, Bill Conrat was the assistant district attorney of a small county in Texas near Dallas. And he was caught up in one of these To Catch a Predator sting operations. To Catch a Predator came to the town of Murphy, Texas, back in November of last year and set up one of their decoy houses there. They leased a house and wired it for sound and video and brought in their consultants, this group called Perverted Justice, that they pay to chat with people online and try to sort of lure them to the decoy houses. And Bill Conrat was one of the chatters, basically, with one of these Perverted Justice decoys. And during the course of the operation there in Murphy, they discovered that he was not who he was presenting himself to be, which was a 19-year-old college student, but was in fact this 57-year-old assistant district attorney.
And as you talk about in your article, what happened was because he's a prosecutor, and the producers of the TV show found out about this, they got very, very interested in his participation in this because, it's kind of a big deal if you get somebody who's in law enforcement doing this and they had never had a prosecutor. But the thing was, as you write, he didn't ever actually show up at the house. So they sort of took the mountain to Muhammad, I guess.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think there was a lot of excitement behind the scenes when they discovered who he was. He was in the words of the police chief there in Murphy, and the words were relayed to me by another cop. He was a big fish, and I think that's how Dateline viewed him as well.
So they show up at his house.
Which they don't usually do.
They don't usually do. This was actually the first time they actually made the decision to go confront somebody at their own house, because you know, usually, as you explained, the guys come to the decoy house.
And what happened when they got to this guy Bill Conrad's house?
When they got to the house, they knocked on the door and
hey, police or.
Well, there were a number of there were two different police agencies involved. The people that were actually first on the scene, Chris Hansen and the Dateline crew were there before the cops were, they were there fairly early in the morning, and then the cops were waiting on warrants. And by the time the cops had their warrants together, actually cops from this town called Murphy and cops from the town where Bill Conrad lived, which was a town called Terrell, went together basically and knocked on the door, and he didn't respond. And so eventually they called in, and they telephoned him once, as far as I could determine, and he didn't answer the phone. And so then they decided to call in the SWAT team, and so the SWAT team went in, and when they confronted him in a hallway, he killed himself. He shot himself in the head.
And from reading your article, it seems like. I mean, he was breaking the law in that he was chatting with this decoy. That's illegal. But he at some point seemed to be kind of cutting it off. He stopped returning the calls to this decoy. It was kind of like – it was murky as to if this was a guy who who maybe should have gone after, certainly the way they did in your mind.
Well, I think – I mean, it's the – you know, the story has a lot of gray areas. And certainly what Bill Conrad was doing which was talking to somebody who he may or may not have thought was actually a minor. I mean, I think one thing that you have to remember is that Bill Conrad was himself pretending to be a 19-year-old, and he was talking to a 21-year-old Hollywood actor who was pretending to be a 13-year-old. So you have two of-age people pretending to be much younger than they actually are, talking to one another. Under Texas law, a minor is not it, when you're talking about sort of online sex cases. A minor is not somebody who is, you know, under the age of consent. A minor is somebody who presents themselves to be under the age of consent. So, there's a good legal argument to say that he was breaking the law. I think the question, though, becomes is the way the case was handled, was it handled in the right way? Was it rushed for the purposes of making better TV? There are a lot of questionable actions. I mean, certainly what Bill Conrad did was very questionable, but I think what Dateline did and what the police officers that were involved that day did, I think a lot of the things they did were also very questionable.
We actually reached out to NBC to get a comment from them, and they sent back this statement. They said, "The notion that Chris Hansen or anyone at Dateline could or would control or manipulate the actions of law enforcement personnel is preposterous. Furthermore, there's no reason to believe that Conrad was aware of Dateline's investigation. Given that we are facing a meritless lawsuit in this case that we will defend ourselves against vigorously, we don't have any further comments." So is someone in Bill Conrad's family suing NBC
Bill Conrad's sister filed last month a $105 million wrongful death lawsuit against NBC. And that is the statement you just read is more or less the boilerplate statement that they've been sending out to a lot of people. And it doesn't really mesh with what I learned when I was working on this story. I mean, I had the argument that Dateline puts forth is that what they do is conduct parallel investigations, that basically Dateline is doing their investigation and the cops are doing their investigation, and they don't influence one another. And that's how they sort of ethically justify what it is they do. But what I discovered looking into the story was that doesn't seem to, if there ever was really a wall between law enforcement and Dateline, that wall crumbled completely during the course of this whole Bill Conrad thing. I mean, I had a detective who was in the Murphy Police Department, who told me about overhearing a telephone conversation about 50 minutes before the order was given to get warrants on Bill Conrad, telling me that he had overheard a conversation between another lieutenant in the department who was relaying a message to the chief of police saying that that Dateline wanted them to get warrants on Bill Conrad for the next morning. And he was a very credible source. Also, in terms of whether or not they were controlling the investigation at all, I mean, I had mentioned that the cops called in and placed a telephone call to Bill Conrad the day that, you know, right before they sent the SWAT team in. Well, they didn't even have that telephone number themselves. They got that literally from Chris Hansen. Chris Hansen read that telephone number to the cops, and then he made that telephone call, and then they made the telephone call. So there's this swapping of information that goes on all the time. The district attorney of the town where they set up this decoy house eventually rejected every single arrest that was made, declined to prosecute any of them.
That's actually something that I've sort of wondered about, Luke, and I've seen the show with a lot of people, and I've heard this come up a few times, which is, legally speaking, do these charges tend to stick? Is it actually he always does this thing at the end where after he comes out and confronts someone, he says, I have to tell you that my name's Chris Hansen and I'm with Dateline NBC, which I assume is some kind of a legal thing so they can use the videotape of it. There's all kinds of stuff like that that's kind of murky. Does it seem to be legal what they're doing, and do these things stick?
Well, I'm not a lawyer or a prosecutor, but I can say that when the district attorney of Collin County, which is the county that Murphy, which is where they set up the decoy house, when he looked at these cases, he decided that that they would not stick, that there were too many problems with them. I think there were technical problems with them. There were more fundamental problems. He found that it looked like the arrests themselves all may have actually been illegal arrests because there had been no real prior investigation on the part of the police department before these arrests were made. Basically, you've got a bunch of cops sitting outside of a decoy house waiting for a signal from NBC, basically, that inside the decoy house, letting them know when these guys are about to walk out, and then they arrest these guys and they tackle them and throw them to the ground, handcuff them and cart them away. At that point, they literally often don't even have copies of the transcripts. The transcripts that are the basis, sort of the evidence in the case, is passed to them later on by another NBC employee. And so you've got a situation where, as the district attorney put it to me, he said, these cops in these situations are more or less potted plants. They're set scenery. They're just there for the purposes of television. And that's troubling. I mean, I think the basic question that I'm exploring in the article is it's a bad thing for cops to influence the media, for sure. You don't want the cops influencing the media, and you also don't want the media influencing law enforcement. And, mm-hmm. and it, unfortunately, that's what seemed to take place here. And the real question is, did Dateline become an agent of the Murphy Police Department, or did the Murphy Police Department become an agent of Dateline NBC?
Well, Luke, we'll leave it to our listeners to check out your article in this month, September's Esquire magazine. Luke Dittrich with Esquire. Thank you very much for talking to us about this.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
It's time now to get a quick news update.
This is NPR.
With Matt Martinez.
Thanks, Luke. The Government Accountability Office says that 13 of the 18 benchmarks set to measure the troop surge in Iraq have not been met. The White House on Thursday downplayed the report. The White House today downplayed the report, saying that standards were too high to meet. A panel report on the Virginia Tech shooting says school administrators could have acted faster and saved lives. Toys R Us recalled 27,000 crayon and paint sets made in China because the packaging of the wooden box contains lead. And firefighters in Greece are trying to gain control of the last remaining major fire there. More of these stories are all online all the time at npr.org. I'm Matt Martinez. Back to you guys.
Thank you very much, Matthew.
You're welcome.
We actually noticed that there was, of the many people who have passed away and were written about in the various papers, there was a couple of them that jumped out at us because they had kind of lived unique lives or had, some kind of interesting experiences. A guy who just recently passed away, his name is Arthur Jones. He invented the Nautilus fitness machine?
He's the guy that I should blame for that. I'm a little bit sore this morning after being at the gym. Well,
but
Allie, I don't want to speak ill of him.
No, no, no. But I think he probably, I don't know the guy, but I bet you he would actually be happy to hear that that his machine gave you a good workout. He was 80 years old when he passed away of natural causes at his home in Ocala, Florida. He was described as a wild animal
enthusiast.
I think.
Ocala.
Yeah. Ocala. He was a wild animal enthusiast, a filmmaker, and entrepreneur.
Okay, come on. What's the best thing about him?
He had six wives.
Yes. Come on. That's the best line in there.
But he was so fit. He was so fit. He just, you know, he never had trouble apparently attracting another lady. He also kept crocodiles and rattlesnakes on his farm. The first Nautilus machine he invented was called the Blue Monster, and he invented it in the 60s after 20 years of research.
Someone who I interviewed a couple of times and who really is a fixture in New York City, the founder of CBGB's passed away, Hilly Kristal. He died at 75 from complications related to lung cancer. He founded the club in 1973. If you like punk rock music, if you like any of the children of the punk rock music scene, you should thank Hilly Kristal because he really, really launched that that club and really showcased some amazing acts from the Ramones to Talking Heads, got their start there. It had to close down in October last year because they lost their rent, their lease in a rent dispute. But Hilly Kristal, really a pioneer in the music industry.
My little brothers who live in Silverdale, Washington, you know, never have even been to New York. They walk around in CBGB's t-shirts because they love the Ramones. I mean, it's amazing to see the influence of this funky little club that felt like always like the walls were about to collapse in on you.
And the ceiling. It was so tiny. And so at the bathroom, we shouldn't even talk about that.
Yeah, let's not. Let's move on to a guy, Richard Jewell. Now, that name rings a bell. It's because you heard a lot about him during the Atlanta Olympic Summer Games. He was a guard at the Olympic Park when there was an explosion that killed one person and hurt a bunch of others. He was initially called a hero because he had sort of warned everyone about this backpack and kind of cleared the area out. Then they thought he was maybe a suspect. I think we have some tape.
I dare say there's more people that know that I was accused of it and was a suspect or called a suspect than know I was the one that actually found the package and that I was cleared.
Yeah, because what they eventually figured out was that he didn't do it.
It was a huge, huge error on the part of the news media. I mean, they put him out there as the Olympic Park bomber before anybody really, really checked it out.
Yeah, I mean, and he spent the rest of his life as a kind of a footnote as a guy who was wrongly done. I guess you could say at least he was also well known for that fact. A lot of people who get wrongly accused, when they exonerate them, it's on the back page of the newspaper. Richard Jewell was 44 years old. They say no foul play is suspected. Allison Stewart.
Luke Burbank.
2 hours of the Bryant Park Project. Some of it was even good. Thank you so much to Dan Pashman, who worked so hard, MJ Davis, Lauren Spohr, wherever you are at Columbia.
Win Rosenfeld.
Yeah.
Matt Martinez. And Manoli.
Yes, Manoli Weatherill. Thank you, too. This has been the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. Have an excellent long weekend, and we'll see you real soon.